Let's start there. So you definitely like to open with five verses and then sister Rhonda the next time. You don't have your glasses, so okay, we'll go to Sister Connie and keep going on around. Daniel, third chapter, starting in verse 1. All right, Sister Connie, like to start us off?
Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits, and the breadth, therefore, 6 cubits, set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent to gather together the princes, the governors, and the captains, the judges, and treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces, to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. Then the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then an herald cried aloud to you, "It is command, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye shall fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king hath set up."
And whoso falleth not down and worship shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, at that time when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image."
Verse 11. "And that anyone who refuses will be thrown into a flaming furnace. But there are some Jews out there, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whom you have put in charge of Babylonian affairs, who have defiled you, refusing to serve your gods or to worship the golden statue you set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in a terrible rage, ordered Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be brought in before him. "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego," he asked, "that you are refusing to serve my gods or to worship the golden statue I set up? I will give you one more chance. When the music plays, if you fall down and worship the statue, all will be well. But if you refuse, you will be thrown into a flaming furnace within the hour. And what god can deliver you out of my hands?"
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spoke and commanded that they should heat the furnace 1 7 times more than it was wont to be heated. And he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning, fiery furnace.
Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast in the midst of the burning, fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent and the furnace exceeding hot, the flames of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down, bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished, and rose up in haste, and spake and said unto his counselors, Did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto the king, True, O king. He answered and said, Lo, I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God.
Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of the blazing fire. He responded and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire. The satraps, the prefects, and the governors, and the king's high officials gathered around and saw, in regard to those men, that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their heads singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as to not to serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no God who is able to deliver in this way. Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the kingdom of Babylon, or province of Babylon.
Very good, thank you. So, Brother Newton, you're very familiar with this chapter, but a reread of it, because we're going into some of the details, it's going to be some of the things we're going to consider. But it's very peculiar, as you know, that in the book of Daniel, we have two accounts. There are two different kings, two different settings, and yet so similar, because we got Daniel cast into the lion's den under the Persian king, Darius. So you say to yourself, how peculiar that you've got these two heathen kings, both in Babylon. The one had conquered the earlier one, as it were. Nebuchadnezzar was Babylonish, and Darius actually was a Mede. The Medes and Persians had conquered them. But you have all four of these children that were brought from Israel to Babylon while they were young under Nebuchadnezzar's instruction. Our three here, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and of course Daniel. And they were faithful in the first chapter. Daniel interpreted the dream in the second chapter. Here in the third chapter, these three are on trial and prove faithful. And then later we have Daniel in the lion's den, like we say with King Darius. He too is tested in such a way and proves faithful. So it's just very interesting that out of the four, all four end up with a similar type of trial and experience. And in this situation with these three, we feel that they would represent the final feet members of the body of Christ, or the little flock, the final members of the 144,000 who will prove faithful and be delivered through persecution because of their faithfulness to the Lord God Almighty in not bowing down to a man-made image nor worship any other false god, doctrine, or practices, even though the civil authority oppresses and threatens them. Their final testimony is part of what we want to consider and connect to New Testament testimonies so that we can see it as the overall picture. So with that being said, the setting here is about 20 years after the Daniel interpreted the dream for Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel, the second chapter. You remember, of course, that's the metallic image with the head of gold, the chest of silver, the brass stomach, and then the thigh, and then the iron legs, and then the toes mixed with clay and iron together. But In Daniel 2, verse 38, Daniel's interpretation was clear that Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. So in the interim, approximately 20 years, Nebuchadnezzar continued to go from victory to victory in his military conquest, so that at this point in time of our chapter, the setting would be is that he is now wanting to consolidate his empire that is a group of mixed peoples and nationalities. So for example, to see that, let's see here. Verse 4, that it's declared that when a herald crieth aloud to you, it's commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time you hear the sound of these musical instruments, you're to bow down and to the image. So representation here at this plain of Dura is all these different peoples, all these different languages from all these different nations, and they're all part of the vast Babylonian Empire now, of which Nebuchadnezzar is wanting to consolidate and unify. So people have known, and Satan knows, who's behind this, knows that if you have a combination of civil authority with religious conviction, the two together is the strongest power you can have to control the people under your authority. Civil alone is only so good, religion alone is only so good, but when you combine the two together, you've got the strongest power in order to control masses of people. And it's proved itself out historically. Every pharaoh of Egypt wanted to be worshipped and be the civil authority. The Babylonians wanted to be the religious and civil authority. The Roman emperors, prior to the Christian conversion, the pagan emperors, they were thought to be one of the gods of the Roman Empire, so that they too were worshipped. They were the Pontifex Maximus, the master bridge builder, who when the papacy came into power, the popes received that title from the pagan emperors who had had it earlier, and then as the emperors turned Christian, so-called, then they finally passed it on to the popes, that they became Pontifex Maximus, master bridge builder. But actually, it goes back to heathen origin in Rome. So the papacy, the pope, what is he? Again, it's a civil and religious authority combined into one. That's what people love. The Church of England, same thing. The head of the Church of England is supposed to be civil authority and then the religious authority at the same time. So when their two are combined, it's extremely powerful. So in the nation of Israel, how did God prevent that from happening to the best of his ability? What did God do?
He made a priest.
He had two divisions of the kings, the civil authority, and the priests, the religious authority. The priests were from the tribe of Levi, the kings were from the tribe of Judah, and so they were split in such a way. But when you have it in the right hand, you want a king and a priest to rule over you, because then you've got the best of both worlds if it's in the right hands. So our Lord Jesus, he's a king, he's the lion of the tribe of Judah. He is the rightful king because he has purchased the earth with his own precious blood. And yet, he is a priest, but he's a priest of what? After the order of Melchizedek, not the Levites. It's a new priesthood. It's of the new creation. So he's a king and a priest. And then what's the hope for the 144,000? Being kings and priests, reign with our Lord to bless the people. So the priest's work is to bring people and God into a harmonic relationship with one another. That's the real goal. Satan has used that to try to bring the people under his spiritual religious control as well as under using his civil authority. He counterfeits that which God had instituted. God in the garden was to be worshipped, and he also was the lawgiver. And so that's called a theocracy. That is a religious government. A theocracy. Theo is for God. Theocracy is the thought of a religious government. That is proper and true, but there's only the one true authority for that, the Lord God Almighty. And then he invested power into Jesus to be the king and priest. And he had a call that there would be a body body members for Jesus, otherwise known as the bride, and that's what 144,000 likewise are kings and priests. So in the end, all of your kings and priests, if you will, we know the exact number, it's 144,000 and one, including Jesus, and they have immortality. And this came up Friday night, I was not making that connection, but that was part of our discussion. They alone receive immortality. The kings and priests alone receive immortality. Deathproofness. And of course, Jehovah God is accepted because he has that. So, this is all part of the setting on why Nebuchadnezzar wanted to set this up, why Satan works through this pathing, and when we look at the symbolic lesson, Babylon represents Christendom. So we look at Nebuchadnezzar, this is ahead of Christendom. And so what we're seeing is the religious leaders working with the civil powers in order to control the people, to control the means of worship, and that's exactly what the adversary wants. So what we read about Babylon here and what took place, we're looking for the symbolic interpretation in, you know, for us here at this end of the age, as it were. So, okay, that being said, let's fill this out a little bit more. In chapter 3, verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold. So gold represents the divine nature or divine authority. Now, as previously mentioned, he was called the head of gold. So here, he likely made the entire image of himself out of gold, but not solid gold because it's too big. Would be too heavy as well, but that's too big, too much gold. So it's probably cast around some kind of substance. So it's 90 feet tall by about 9 feet wide. So think of it as a 9-story tall building, more or less, quite big. But like the Statue of Liberty, it probably had a base on which it stood, so the statue itself may or may not have been that full 90 feet. It's okay, if you think it is, that's fine. However, the plain of Dura was in the center of the city of Babylon. And this plain of Dura is thought to have encompassed about 24 square miles, so it's like huge. But the city of Babylon was even huger. But the thought is that at the center of the city, with this statue in the center of that plain, it could be easily seen by all the inhabitants of the city. So with Christendom, what they want in front and center is they want to have this supposedly divine goal, image, that is a representation of that which is to be worshipped and obeyed. We'll talk more on that. But that's what Christendom wants to. They want to have front and center a supposed divine origin, an image which is to be worshipped and obeyed. And that's going to be what we'll talk about more. Now with this, in verse 2, Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes. Now I'm going to reread this, but I'm going to reread it now, but I'm going to insert what we're going to suggest as a possible interpretation for our end of the age. So we don't have to keep rereading this over and over. Nebuchadnezzar would represent the head of civil authority in this situation. The princes might represent the international leaders of industry, princes. The international leaders of finance. But the governors here might represent the national civilian leaders versus the international. But the captains here might represent the military leaders. The judges would represent legislators or judges, if you will. The treasurers would represent national financial leaders as opposed to what we had mentioned earlier of international financial leaders. These would be national financial leaders. Your counselors would represent national political leaders. And your sheriffs would represent law enforcement leaders. And the rulers of the provinces would be municipal leaders. Now, let's break that down a little bit. You have your international politicos, for example, and that's your ambassadors of different countries exchange. That would also could represent your secretaries of state who travel abroad in order to affect business, as it were, for the different countries. A national civilian leader could represent our governors, could easily represent other state legislators. And then your rulers of provinces, which we're saying are municipal leaders, those would be like your mayors and of your major cities. So throughout the year, you know, in the United States, you have these different gatherings. You have national leaders. Governors go down to Washington, D.C. To meet with the head of the national leadership. Then you have municipal leaders that meet. Mayors go down, and they too have a grand meeting with the United States civil government, as it were, overall, to try to plead their arguments for different needs and organizational helps and such. So we hear that every once in a while on the news, how that happens. But the thought is that it's all-encompassing of whatever divisions one wants to make throughout Christendom, whether you're in Europe, the United States, Canada, Australia, whatever it may be. It's the thought of the picture is that they're all the leaders are included in this. Then with that being said, we note that there's something that isn't mentioned in this list in verse 2, but they appear later. And those players are found in verse 8. After this proclamation was made and the music sounded, and you have this tremendous musical fanfare, what we find is that Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, the three Hebrew leaders over provinces, they didn't bow down. They were standing. Kind of reminds me, it's like the reverse of that NFL quarterback who doesn't want to stand up for the national anthem. It's kind of like the reverse of that. So they really stood out, these three. So in verse 8 it says, "Wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near," that is, came near to King Nebuchadnezzar, "and accused the Jews, and spake and said unto King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever," and then they go on. The Chaldeans weren't mentioned in this earlier list. The Chaldeans were the soothsayers. They were supposedly the spiritual leaders and ones with spiritual insight. You remember it was the Chaldeans that King Nebuchadnezzar had turned to interpret his dream. Not only interpret it, what else did they have to do?
Tell him where it was.
Exactly. So he put a good trick on them. He put them in a trick bag. Let's see how good you are. If I tell you, you can interpret and tell me anything, I would know. But if you're really good, you'll tell me what I dream. So I'm not giving you any clues, except it was a dream. So you tell me what I dream, and you interpret it, and if you can do that, then we're doing pretty good. I have confidence. And who did? But Daniel did it. But it was the Chaldeans who were to have this kind of spiritual, supernatural insight, which Daniel did have. That being said, these Chaldeans would represent the religious leaders who turned to the civil authority to accuse the Lord's faithful of not bowing down to the image. And in the book of Revelation, where we'll look in chapter 13, they don't receive the mark of the image in their forehead or in their hand. They don't receive that mark of the image, nor do they receive the mark of the beast. Two religious organizations, Protestantism or Roman Catholicism. So, with that being said, let's think for, you know what, let's go read that. Keep your hand here and let's go look at Revelation 13. You know, for some of us, it's just more ready in mind, but others of us not as ready. We haven't looked at it in a while, so let's just take a look at it. So in Revelation 13, we see in verse 1, Revelation 13:1, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his head the names of blasphemy." Now, just here, we know that this seven-headed, 10-horned beast with the names of blasphemy represents Roman Catholicism, the papacy. It's this 10-headed beast. Seven-headed, 10-horned beast, which represents a European empire. That's what that helps lead out for us. Previously, it was pagan Rome as the European empire. Now it's papal Rome as the European Empire. That's the picture. Then down in verse 11, and I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and spake as a dragon. This two-horned beast is the Church of England and Ireland. Ireland later broke off, as it were, separated. But it had lamb-like horns in the sense that they weren't as powerful as the ten-horned beast through their civil authority. He only had two horns. He didn't have ten horns. So obviously the ten-horned beast is more powerful. It's got ten compared to two. That would be enough to tell us. But these are lamb-like horns, showing, again, it's not as powerful. The Church of England, England wasn't as powerful as all the nations of Europe put together. But it spake like a dragon. That is, the leading head of this church, like a dragon. Dragon represents civil authority. The civil authority was the king of England, Henry VIII, who created this religious order, the Church of England, in order to suit his needs of desiring to get a divorce and get a new marriage, which the Pope didn't want to do because he was married to a Catherine of Spain who was Catholic, and the Pope wanted to have that kind of influence still over England, but it didn't work out. So, Henry VIII wanted a divorce, wanted to get remarried, so he created his own new religion in order to do so. Immediately you know this is not a good thing. Not a good religion to be part of. However, it looked like the previous beast in that the Pope had both civil and religious authority. This new religious order, this beast, too, was a civil and religious, had civil and religious authority. But primarily, the civil authority was the leading element when it started, King Henry VIII. Then we get down to verse 14. And it's talking about the two-horned beast still, the Church of England. And it says, and deceive them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast. So it's just saying that the Church of England really did, it ended up prospering. And they threw the Catholics out of England, more or less. And that was pretty amazing because no other church group had had that kind of authority to withstand papacy's influence like the Church of England had up to that time. But by doing so, by the Church of England standing up to the papacy and succeeding, by doing so, the rest of the verse says, saying to them that dwell on the earth, that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by the sword and did live. So the beast that had the wound by the sword and lived would have been the Roman church, that ten-horned beast, Roman Catholicism. The wound was by a sword, which is truth, to one of the heads that it had, one of the forms of government that the Roman Catholicism participated in. It wounded to the head. It wasn't a death blow. And so the Reformation dealt a setback to the Roman beast at the time of the Reformation, starting 1517, 1516, with Martin Luther's decree on the door of Wittenberg Castle. The point is, though, it didn't succeed in totally killing Roman Catholicism. There was a counter-Reformation, Catholicism revived, and we have it with us still today. So you have the ten-horned beast living today, you've got the two-horned beast living today, but by those actions, we ended up getting an image of the beast. It's not another beast, it's not a third beast, it's an image of a beast. In other words, as Brother Russell explains, in the 1912 forward to the fourth volume, 16 pages long, he elaborates there that the image of the beast is known as the Evangelical Alliance, which was established in 1846. There was a combination in America and also in Britain of evangelical leaders working together to try to offset the influence of upstart religions like the Brother William Miller movement with the Second Advents, who were outside of orthodoxy on some of their views, and yet the Lord used them mightily to help prepare the way for really Bible student activities, with 1974. But the Evangelical Alliance did not have civil authority. It only had religious authority. So it's only an image of peace. Because a peace, you have to have both religious and civil authority together. They only had religious authority. And so the Evangelical Alliance had a 10-point doctrinal platform, of which was hellfire, trinity, and immortality of the human soul, in order to try to thwart the efforts of upstart Christian religions in the lands in which they resided. Now, they've been around since then, but without a whole lot of success. Other groups have come along to try to capitalize on it, the National Council of Churches, the International Council of Churches, and other Protestant groupings. However, they haven't really reached their power as yet. And yet, in our verse 15, it tells us that, and he, that is that two-horned beast, the Church of England, had power to give life unto the image of the beast. In other words, this Evangelical Alliance, these Protestants, that the image of the beast, that Evangelical Alliance, these federated Protestants, should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. So Brother Russell interprets this that at some point in time, the Church of England is going to give some element of spiritual life, or considered spiritual life, to this Evangelical life or this federated Protestant element, so that they cooperate together and give this image of the life newfound status. Think of like Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein, haven't seen that, the electrical lightning, runs it over to his little creation, he sparks into life and sits up and you got this hodgepodge monster put together. That's like this image of the beast. Dr. Frankenstein is the Church of England, and it just gives us life over. But what's the life? Life is apostolic succession, supposed apostolic succession. Now what's that? The Roman Catholic Church claims that Peter and Paul were there. One of two popes, the first two popes. They were apostles. Everyone recognizes their apostolic authority. We do. But we say there's only 12 apostles of the Lamb. They're the only 12 that could have that apostolic authority. But other church groups, including the Roman Catholics, and then later the Church of England, they claim that their bishops can lay hands on other bishops, new bishops, and confer apostolic authority on them. So they've been passing it down in a succession ever since Peter and Paul. There's no scriptures that say that. They teach it. They believe it. Roman Catholicism said their bishops have this. One of the titles of the Pope is Prince of Bishops, because he's the chief muckety-muck with them. He's got this apostolic authority. But when the Church of England was created and split off, the Church of England said, well, our bishops that had apostolic succession with the Roman Catholic, now that they've left Roman Catholicism and become members of the Church of England, they get to keep their apostolic authority. So now the Church of England, our bishops have apostolic authority that they too can pass on. And the Roman Church said, no. They left, they don't get it anymore. Church of England said, no, too late, we've got it, we can't take it back. So the false doctrine and the pretense of having apostolic authority continues in the Roman Church and in the Church of England. And this is what Brother Russell is suggesting the Federated Protestants will receive in the future, supposed apostolic authority from the Church of England. So in the end, time will have two camps, Roman Catholicism and Orthodoxy, and Federated Protestantism, including the Church of England. With that being said, when this takes place, this is this image of the beast. It's an image of that original 10-horned beast, Roman Catholicism. Everyone recognizes in the Christian world that's the leading so-called Christian organization, and they've all tried to copy it. But it also tells us that at this future time, when this image of the beast, Federated Protestantism, receives life, they are going to speak, that is, they're going to talk, they're going to proclaim certain things, And they're going to cause that as many as would not worship them, their organization, should be killed. Then in verse 16 it says, and he, that is this vivified image of the beast, federated Protestantism, causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that hath the mark or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. So very interestingly, you have Protestants are going to be in a position to ask the civil authority to persecute people, no matter how great, how small, no matter what their social standing, no matter what their economic status, that if they don't cooperate with us, either the mark in the forehead, intellectually agreeing with our doctrines and practices, or in their hand, at least they'll cooperate and work with us. If they don't receive either one of these, then they're persecuted, put to death. So right here is our setting. We have never in the past had Protestants persecute people who won't cooperate with the papacy. One more time. Never in the past have we had Protestants persecute people who won't cooperate with the papacy. That's what these verses are telling us is going to happen in the future. This is how we know it hasn't happened in the past. Protestants have persecuted others who haven't cooperated with fellow Protestants. Perfect example. Remember Calvin? He persecuted Servetus, because Servetus didn't believe in what? Exactly. So they had him persecuted, put to death. Protestant persecuting a fellow Protestant. Persecuted him because he didn't believe in what they considered to be orthodox belief, Trinity. So they roasted him alive. Horrible. We've had, of course, the Inquisition, so we know that Catholics have persecuted people who won't follow Catholic doctrine. But we've never had Protestants persecute people who won't go along with either them or go along with papacy. That's a critical understanding on when this timing of this would take place. That being said, when the image speaks, when you speak, you, in religious terms, you consider to be what? A what? Prophet. That's what the prophets did. They speak on behalf of the Lord. So if you don't speak rightly, you're a false prophet. So later in Revelation, we see that this image of the beast, once it receives this life, becomes a false prophet, speaking falsely, in cooperation with the beast, Roman Catholicism. So they all speak falsely together, promoting the same lie. So let's take a look at Revelation 16 and verse 13. Revelation 16, 13. This is in the period of the sixth plague. But this too is latest future. And I saw three unclean spirits, that is, false teachers, like frogs, that is, they make a lot of noise, but there's no substance. They have the form of godliness, but they're devoid thereof. They come out of the mouth. This is public speaking. This is teachings. This is proclamations. These are decrees. These are anthems of the dragon, which represents civil authority, out of the mouth of the beast, that is our ten-horned beast, that's the papacy, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. The false prophet is that vitalized image of the beast that is now caused to speak. That makes it a false prophet speaking. For they are the spirits, that is, doctrines. Spirits can represent the doctrines or teachings. For they are the doctrines or teachings of demons, working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the whole world to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. So, right here, this is the setting in the future when these three, federated Protestantism, papacy, civil powers, cooperate together, all saying the same thing, they're on the same page. It's a church-state-government relationship in order to try to control the people, and the people of the United States, Canada, and Europe go along with it because there's been some type of financial collapse impending war or terrorism or biological outbreak or you name, pick your problem, even though economic financial collapse is usually the chief motivator. People want to be able to put food on their table. They want to feel secure when they go to bed at night. They don't want to have to sleep with their rifle in their arms. They want law and order to some degree that is now being shaken. And we all know how fast the financial system could come apart. It's all on confidence. If the confidence is shaken, someone starts a war, North Korea sends a nuclear bomb, or Iran does, or Putin gets mad at Trump and they get into a fight. They could attack Europe. Everyone knows Russia has had a large military force, and they took over part of Ukraine. They're massing on the border of Ukraine, they're massing on the border of Poland. If you lived in Europe, especially in Eastern Europe, you would be a lot more aware of what that means than us here in America, because we got an ocean between us, so we don't notice it. But our brother, like Brother Alan Springer, who lives in Romania now, he's very up in tune with all of that, because he's an American, so he thinks like an American, and he communicates with us here, and he watches what's in their newspapers, what's really important to them, that you and I only catch like on the second page of the news, because it's not so important to Americans. But when you got Russian military advisors and tanks in part of Ukraine, and they took over the southern element of it, remember that a couple of years ago? They're still there. We couldn't get, NATO couldn't get them out. But if you're in Romania, you're right next door. I mean, those tanks could drive you to your location in a matter of hours. This is very small space. So I just say all that to say, the world is on edge. We're not even talking about China building these islands in the South Pacific, and now they're arming them. We've got satellite photos of that taking place. So the Chinese are trying to strengthen their military position. Australia is extremely upset. We're increasing our ties with them and Japan. Remember, Japan is largely demilitarized since the end of World War II. They rely on us. And then what? We just signed a deal with Vietnam. Why are we signing a deal with Vietnam? Because Vietnam is afraid of China. Japan's afraid of China. Thailand, they're all afraid of China just taking over that whole area. So the United States is afraid of that too. So we're all combining together. But who's one of the largest buyers of the United States properties? China. who buys so many of the Treasury T-bills of the United States? China. So I was like, what a mix, right? What a mix. So at the Lord's time, and he's only waiting for the 144,000 to be complete, it all can unravel from any one of these scenarios. It all happens extremely rapidly. So I'm going to say all that to say that, we don't have to watch for a lot of, things to develop. There are things to develop, but it could develop very rapidly, and it could unfold. So we think this is what can allow for the psychological mindset of the mass of people who would permit a church-state government to come into existence to try to stem the tide of whatever disorder and chaos was unfolding in the various countries. Okay, that's all we'll say on that. We'll leave that go. And then we'll turn back then to our Daniel, the third chapter, saying that that's some of the New Testament equivalent of what we can be can expect in a setting of what we think Daniel 3 symbolically represents to us. We're in verse 8. The Chaldeans were accusing the three Hebrews of not bowing down to the image. Now that we read in Revelation about the image, let's make some more connections. An image that's 90 feet tall, even if it's not quite a full 90 feet, like a nine-story building, even if it's set on a base, whatever it may be, the way you build it is to, especially with molten metal as part of it, the coating at least, if not just created in a hollow form. You make a mold, and to make a mold that big, you would just make it in a slant, a sand clay base in the earth. Let's say it's 90 feet tall, you make it 90 feet long. You pour one half of your mold, you pour your second half of a mold, and it's in the sand or in the earth. Then you put the two halves together, And when it comes together at such a time that you're ready to assemble it, you stand it up on its base. So what that implies is, like this image of the beast, it's been around since 1846, the Evangelical Alliance. But it's been laying flat, it's in the earth, it's an earthly organization, even though it claims to be spiritual. But the time is coming, we read, that that image will receive life. That's when that image is stood up in that plain of dirt. Then it's given a voice to speak. That's where Nebuchadnezzar gave orders that all these peoples, languages, and nations should come together to worship it. They should all receive the mark in the forehead or in their right hand. They should all cooperate with this church-state arrangement. So it's all in place, as it were. It just hasn't been set up as yet. But when it's set up, what is it? It's a special occasion. The special occasion is this fantastic fanfare. All these musical instruments, and there must have been hundreds of them, because they don't have amplification like we do today. So there have been hundreds of these musicians playing these instruments, creating this probably gorgeous musical fanfare in order to help rev up the sentiments of the people and to help demonstrate the pageantry and the pomp and ceremony that's fit for King Nebuchadnezzar, that all would want to worship his image. Probably looks a lot like him, because his gods apparently are more powerful than the gods of the nations he had defeated. And all these nations represented there, their gods apparently were defeated because they're there subservient to him and his God. So it's as if Protestantism and the papacy cooperate together. Not joined together as one Christian religion, no. They cooperate together under the banner of orthodoxy. And the basic orthodox tenets would be Trinity, some form of hellfire, punishment eternal for the lost, immortality, human soul, it's the only way they can explain how we get to live into the future. These basic God-dishonoring doctrines as part of the orthodox understanding. So the thought would be is that when that is empowered, that's what's set up before the people, and that it is a divine government. Now when I say divine government, what does that mean? It means that the religious leaders will be saying to the people that your civil authorities are governing you by the power and right and instruction from God. Not like the monarchs, not like the blue blood families of old. Rather, our evangelicals, our Roman Catholics teach today that we should vote Christian leaders to govern the country. And to them, a Christian leader is quite simple. They'll vote for Christians. They're not going to vote for a Muslim. They'll vote for Christians. They're going to want to vote along the lines of what they feel on abortion. They're going to want to vote for them along the lines of on what they feel about affirmative action. They're going to vote for them along the lines in the future, along law and order. Because you remember, Paul wrote very clearly that you should obey the laws of the land unless they're in conflict with God. Paul wrote that the sword is given unto the kings in order to govern the people by the will of God. So in other words, lawbreakers should submit, as it were, to the government of the land in order to have some level of peace and tranquility. And we're told to go along with that. We're even told by Peter to what? Pray for kings. So the thought is, they use those verses in order to compel their people to vote along their lines. So that's their thought of a divine government. Not that the leaders are, you know, more special, it's just that they are aligned with what they want to enforce with their Orthodox Christian viewpoints of what they feel should be endorsed. Along another line on that, by the way, you know it's illegal to promote voting in the church on who you're supposed to vote for. You know, you can't stand up in the pulpit and say vote for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. That's illegal. But you can promote candidates by what they promote. So you can say, well, Trump promotes these values of ours, or Hillary promotes these values of ours, wouldn't that be a good leader? Now you can do that. But what churches do who are active along this political line, and I've received mine in the mail from a Roman Catholic church because I get the inside the Vatican magazine, so I like to keep track of the enemy from the inside. Yeah. However, I got the voting register. I got the voting guide. It's that thick. And the voting guide is telling you, the Catholic reader, lay person, what different candidates are promoting. And it's like supposedly letting you draw the conclusion. But the conclusions are inescapable. So I say all that just to say, as you know, we see it, it surfaces from time to time, but this is what this golden image is waiting to be set up. When it sets up, it will speak. Three unclean spirits come out of its mouth, of the beast and the false prophet, and then the civil powers, the dragon, will cooperate with it. So that's like what we have here. We've got this total cooperative effort except for these three, in their eyes, obnoxious Hebrews who just won't go along with them. So the religious leaders call attention to this, and they're the point. It wasn't the other civil leaders. It wasn't the princes. It wasn't the counselors. It wasn't the judges. It wasn't the captains and the others. It was these Chaldeans who call attention to it. Let's think about that. Who called out Jesus to Pilate? Jewish religious leaders. Who called Elijah out to Ahab? It was Jezebel. And what was she? She was a priestess. Yeah, she was a priestess of Baal worship. And she was a harlot woman. And she was the one in Revelation, the second chapter, Jezebel represents nominal churchianity. So we have that there. We won't turn there, but in Acts 24, you'll remember that the Apostle Paul was called out to Felix the governor by who? Jewish leaders. In Acts 25, Paul was called out to Felix by who? Jewish religious leaders. John the Baptist was called out by Salome and by Herodias. Now, they weren't religious. However, they were two unchaste women, which represented Protestantism and papacy. Calling out John the Baptist, another picture of the final feet members, to Herod, the civil authority. So, brother, we just see a pattern of how this is to take place. It's the religious leaders that call out the faithful feet members of the little flock to the civil authorities. And that's what we think is being depicted here. Now, as we had mentioned, I'm going to call it a national holiday. I can't say that for sure, but it sure was a great celebration, right? It was special with the fanfare, everyone gathered, and everyone to bow down together. This was like huge. So likewise, we see in Scripture other examples of where some national event, or if not national event, some striking event was taking place in which the adversary works behind the scenes in the commotion and in the excitement in order to persecute the faithful witnesses in the setting. So with Jesus, he was persecuted with what national event?
Passover.
Yeah. And what else was taking place as far as Pilate was concerned? It was an annual... annual release of one prisoner. And they called for Barabbas. He was hoping for Jesus. But he said he was apt to do it. It was since he took over as the governor there in 26 AD. Here he is in 33 AD. It's become like an annual event that the Jews look forward to. They got to choose a release of a prisoner, usually a political prisoner, like Barabbas. He was a prisoner. Okay, so there was a saying. With Herod, when John the Baptist was persecuted, it was, what was the event?
His birthday.
His birthday. And that's how come that got the two women, in nefarious women, in this position to persecute him. They were drunk, and Herod was intoxicated, made a big boast, and offered a promise, and because it was his birthday. It was a celebration in that way. When Babylon fell, in Daniel, the fifth chapter, when the city of Babylon fell, what was going on the night it fell? There was a big party, a big feast. They were drinking, and Belshazzar's feast. And the city of Babylon falls, is showing one of those odd kind of things. Now, you might not have noticed this. When Daniel was cast in the lion's den, it's very short, but it too is a special arrangement. This is Daniel 6. And Daniel was extremely high in the government position. When the Medes and the Persians took over, Darius exalted Daniel. And it made the others jealous against him. The others who weren't Jewish, they made it. See in verse 4, that the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom. So what happens is they create this problem regarding his religion. They say that's the only thing we're going to find fault with him. And down in verse 7, all the presidents of the kingdom, the governors, the princes, the counselors, the captains, you get the same cadre of people, consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save thee, O king, he shall be cast into the lions. So you see, you had this 30-day special arrangement where you couldn't pray to anybody, God or man, and ask for anything, unless you asked it to King Darius. Well, Darius sounded, oh, that sounds good. Everyone's got to come to me. I'm the man. But Daniel wouldn't do it. He just prayed in his own home. So again, this is an example. And this is amazing. We find both in this, those four children taken captive as children, as young teenagers to Babylon, ended up being used of God in depicting the faithfulness of his people. So, okay. That being said, though, a 30-day special period. That's a point I really want to make on that. So we do have these examples of special events that help create the psychological atmosphere in which people are getting carried away at excess rather than focusing on the logic of what's actually taking place. Now back in the third chapter in verse 4, we notice it says, then a herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that what time you hear the sound of these instruments here to fall down and worship. So the herald crying aloud is very nervous. Very interesting. We can't say that we have an exact understanding of it. What we can say is there is a starting point. So let's backtrack. The image is created over a period of time, laying down in the earth, in its mold, being created. So 1846, the image has been laying down in its mold, being created. At some point in time in the future, when the Church of England gives life unto federated Protestantism, the image comes alive, or this image here stands up vertical. It's up there. Then, sometime after that, and probably not long, why wait? Sometime shortly after that, this vivified image speaks, causing all who won't receive the mark of the beast or the image to be killed. That time frame is the equivalent, I'm going to suggest, to this herald crying aloud. You hear the music, you got to bow down or die. Same time period, same frame, same instance. There's going to be a decree in this country and across other lands of Christendom. You either cooperate with this church state arrangement, with our Orthodox views, or you're going to be persecuted. And people who really don't believe it intellectually, like this really isn't right, but they're afraid, they'll cooperate. That's the mark in the handle. Let's go along with it. So that's where we'll be tested. I'm receiving that mark in the forehead or in the hand. Just like Christians have been tested throughout the entire gospel age. Brother, this part is not new. Faithful Christians to the Lord have been tested on accepting doctrinal beliefs or practices all throughout the entire gospel age. Actually, we're living at the time that's actually been the easiest. Because the Protestants were persecuted when they wouldn't accept the Pope, when they wouldn't accept transubstantiation. Many thousands, if not millions, over the centuries died from this. The Waldensians, the Albigenses, you know the history. The early church, most of the apostles were martyred that we know about, either by pagan Rome or by the Jewish. Our own Lord and Master suffered that way. Our John the Baptist suffered that way. He wasn't of the church, but nonetheless, he was the last of the faithful in the ancient world. So us living in our time, we're the ones that by and large are escaping this kind of dramatic persecution. But it's only because the adversary has not been able to set the stage and make the arrangements in order to effect such a persecution. And the time will come, though, we think, that they will for this short period of time. And this is what you and I are just us to be aware of. This is really what we are keeping our mind open for. And it probably might not be as obvious as I'm making it. Maybe it will be found more subtle. But we certainly don't think it's the microchip in the hand. We certainly don't think it's just receiving a social security number, which a lot of evangelicals put out there that this is the mark. You're going to get a literal microchip. You know, like you put in your dog, you track your dog, and it gets lost or something. We don't think it's that, because what does God care about that? The point is your cooperation or your mental assent to false doctrines, which dishonors his name. So for you and I, it should be pretty obvious. But we never can tell with the fear factor. Because it could be a threat to our families, it could be a threat to our loved ones, it could be just, you know, a threat to us in any variety of ways. The point is, like these three, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, we want to have the character that would say, verse 16. They answered and said unto the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. In other words, they didn't have to think about it. They didn't have to weigh it up. Nope. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of thy hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Just like that. We don't have to be careful in this matter. We don't have to debate it. We're not like, you know, can I think about it? This is what we want to try to be like. Well, let's call on two different historic examples of how this happened. Remember when Luther was called before the Roman Catholic officials, it wasn't the Pope, but the officials, and he had left Germany and he went to this court, and when he was there, they called him out, and they read portions of his writings in this court, and they said, are these your writings? Do you agree with these, or do you recant? And remember Luther at that time, that one instance? He wanted to think about it. He said, all right, overnight. So he's up in his room overnight thinking about it. And he came down, and that's where we have the famous explanation. And he elaborated on it like they did then. He made it much better than what I can repeat to you now, except for the famous words, here I stand. And he basically said, I'm paraphrasing, I'm not giving it due justice, but basically, it wouldn't be wise to not follow my conscience before God. Even if they're even out of fear of man, I have to follow my conscience before God. Those are my rights. I cannot recant them. And he took his position. And he was willing to suffer whatever consequences came. He was rescued by the German princes and eventually he escaped their persecution. But thereafter they did try to kill him, and he was only protected by the authorities because it wasn't the time for Luther to end and with his teachings. Now, He would have been better if he didn't take that night, right? He would have been better if he just said right then and there, those are my teachings, I don't recant. Because, you know, whenever we delay on anything, it's not a good thing. There's another example, I get their names mixed up, either it was Latimer or Cramer. I don't get the, they're two English reformers, I get mixed up on it. I was at the spot in Oxford where they were burned at the stake during the Protestant Reformation. And they have a big statue of them down the road, but in the very place where they were burned at the stake, it's in the middle of a road, and surrounded by Oxford University. It's not just one university, it's a series there of buildings and stuff. And there's just a round plug saying this is where it was, in the road. You drive and you walk over it, unless you paid attention and knew what you were looking for, you wouldn't see it. But we happened to, you know, we were there and we were looking for it, and what we were directed to, and we got to see it. But one of them, and I get them mixed up, so I won't say, one of them signed a recantation to be spared from burning. So he signed a recantation of his views, his Protestant views. But the next day, he recanted his recantation. And when they let him out to the stake, he put his hand in the fire. He said, let this hand burn first, that ever would have thought of me denying, you know, my beliefs. And then they proceeded to roast him. So, we want to have this attitude of mind that would be like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And it has to be so firmly a part of our character, which is why we prepare in advance, that we don't want to think, oh, it'll just be so easy to be lined up and shot. We don't know what kind of pressure they bring to bear. You can watch any one of these goofy movies out there that depict that they don't kill you, they're going to kill the one you love, right? Recant or I kill her or him, Ruth.
It's Cranmer.
Cranmer, thank you. Mm-hmm. What year does it have there?
1556.
So right after Luther. Thank you. Maybe that'll stick in my mind now. So we don't know what kind of pressures they bring to bear. But that's where you and I are blessed, out of all the brethren that have gone before us back until the days of the apostles, that we've got the plan of the age. We know that all people will come forth from the grave. A lot of these who died, they didn't know what their family members were, what their eternal future was going to be. We do. That's why we're so blessed. That's why we can have a peace that surpasses all our mental reasonings, because we have proven God's love and justice continually in our Bible studies. That's why we keep going over. It's all part of what is meant to help strengthen our convictions on what we believe, so when we're in the emotional fiery furnace, the new creature will have the ascendancy in its conduct rather than our quaking and shaking physical flesh. And that's what the Lord has promised. So, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego demonstrated that. Now, with that, it is interesting, when we talk about the musical accompaniment, you remember in Revelation, the 15th chapter, it talks about the song of Moses and the Lamb, which none but 144,000 could sing. And they were given harps, and they played these harps. And the harps is depicted as having 10 strings, or the 10 doctrines, fundamental doctrines of the plan of God that we understand as truth. And they can make the beautiful music of this glorious plan of the ages as outlined here visually. And so the harmony is how to bring out from the Word of God on these doctrinal understandings the beauty of God's character in ransom and restitution of all through His Son, Jesus Christ. That's what the 144,000 are able to sing. But here we have the counterfeit. Satan, we know, and Ezekiel 28, he had the pipes. He was created with musical talent. That's one of the things the adversary was known for when he was Lucifer. So here, though, the power of music to assist in the emotional reactions of the people, either for good or for poor, here it is trying, it's being presented. It's a counterfeit of the Song of Moses and the Lamb. This music is, as it were, is to support this supposed church-state relationship, this exaltation of an earthly image and that they should all bow down and worship it. So they create their literal music, which is a counterfeit, along with their counterfeit doctrines. And that's what all these gods, you notice it's gods plural that they're to bow down to and worship. Nebuchadnezzar is part of the chiefest or the representative of these gods. But those would be all the various false doctrines and practices that we're familiar with. Hellfire, immortality, human soul, and such. All that is part of what is being presented as these false gods. You know, sometimes it's underestimated the power of music, for example, but if you've ever been to any concerts, usually what's a good way of describing it? Let's put it this way. You've probably seen in movies, I don't think any of us were old enough, even our oldest here, to remember back to the Roaring Twenties. But in the Roaring Twenties, there was a reaction after the end of World War I, and the soldiers came home. There was kind of a very liberal kind of sentiment. It was combined with some peculiarities like they prohibited the sale of alcohol.
Prohibition,
thank you. Prohibition movement, which meant that if you wanted to drink alcohol, you had to go to these underground clubs and various things. So it was all part of this creating almost an underground atmosphere of we're defying the government and we're defying religious authority by getting happy and partying. And then came with it was looser morality. And the dance and the music of that time helped assist in that. Not too many, you know, got that way out of, waltzes. Just wasn't quite the same. So it's not hard. So then you ramp that up to rock and roll, and then you can have rock and roll, you can have it like the Eagles, okay? Or you can have it like the Rolling Stones, let's say. And they aren't the same. They're both rock and roll, but they're different. The long and short of it is, if you've gone to any of the concerts and how they party at the concerts, then you can see that that is even more removed than what they were doing in the Roaring Twenties. And it's just a further break from the norms, the rules of both civil, because drinking underage and the drugs are illegal, along with the break from spiritual or religious authority, which is all part of this rebellion that somehow seems exhilarating when you're all together. And if you read anything about the Burning Man, anybody follow the Burning Man? If you read anything about the history of the Burning Man and how that all happens in Nevada, now it started out in California. Anyway, when you read what that's all about, the background of that, you'll come to understand that all that is just like an amplification of this break from the norms of society. We're going to get out here and we're going to cut loose along all these fronts. Burning Man Festival. All right. I'm using this as an example to just show how you have this grand musical outline and it can move the passions of people. So this is a type of thing that's used to illustrate when you have these religious conviction beliefs coupled with the civilian authority working together on the same page, three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of their mouths, all giving forth the same very intoxicating message of false doctrine with civil authority, the people fall in line to it. And that's where you get people who are considered political zealots along any lines. You can be a Republican zealot, you can be a Democratic zealot. You just have a certain way of thinking and you become zealous over that whole avenue. Now the reason I'm emphasizing all of this angle is to say that it's not going to be like what we see today. That's my point. What we see out here today is not what we're talking about. We're talking about a different social environment than what we have today. Because so many of the brethren, they just can't see this. Probably more brethren can't see this as happening in the future than do. That's why I think all the time to emphasize all this. It's not going to be the environment that we see today. And Brother Russell held very clearly to this right up to and including the 1916 forwards, that's a month before he died. He was saying the Bible teaches this is what we're to expect. So his conviction was based on these kind of scriptures that we're considering, rather than just looking out and seeing what was going on in the world before him. Okay. The religious leaders accuse the three Hebrews for not bowing down. They bring him before Nebuchadnezzar. And in verse 13, it tells us Nebuchadnezzar he's furious. And he brings these three before him. And he reiterates the very threat. If you don't bow down, you're going to be thrown in the fiery furnace. Doesn't it sound like he's reluctant to throw them in the fiery furnace? Why give them a second chance? Why did they say, oh, well, okay, they didn't bow down, they're gone. But did Pilate want to crucify Jesus? Did Herod want to behead John the Baptist? Did Darius want to throw Daniel in the lion's den? Darius was up all night, remember? And then the story goes, Daniel slept better with the lions than the king in his own bed. So, the religious leaders are reluctant to get involved with, I said this wrong, the civil leaders are reluctant to get involved with the religious leaders because the civil leaders recognize the religious leaders are not acting logically. They're acting out of religious conviction, which is emotional for them. However, they feel that they're pinned in. They have to cooperate, just like those ones we mentioned. And so, too, here in Nebuchadnezzar. He tried to give them an out, but it was decreed he couldn't. So he cast them into the fiery furnace. But let's get down there to verse 19. He heats the furnace seven times more than it was one, or seven being a symbol of perfection. This is the perfect test, the perfect trial of these feet members pictured by these three Hebrews. It reminds us of Revelation 15. In fact, we've got to turn there. Keep your hand here, but let's look at Revelation 15. Verse 2. Yes. If the friends want to continue the next hour, there will be other parts of this we would look into for sure. And then I had another game plan for part of that time if you want. And I brought the 50 scriptural event chart. I brought it up for us all. And what I wanted to do was use it. It is a tool. It's not etched in stone. It's not paper. And go ahead.
I make a motion that we give you the next hour.
Okay, thank you. Is there a second? Okay, thank you. I'll be talking about a second before you vote. I say, well. Because we're in the fourth volume now where we're getting, where we're in the end times scenarios, Brother Russell draws it out from Matthew 24, and then we're going to get into Jacob's trouble. Because we're now embarking in the end time scenario, we thought it might be good to have a review of the sequence of events as best we can make it from these 50 different scriptures, and then I want to open it for questions. So if you all looked at it, and if anyone has questions on part of this, then we'd like to kind of give that opportunity for part of that. And it just seems that it's easy to be confused on elements of it, because it's like playing 3D chess. You've got to kind of keep not only one board in mind, you're trying to take into consideration you can move between board levels as well. And that's what it's like trying to keep 50 scriptural events in our minds as we're talking. That's why we say it's a tool. Might not be exactly right, but it's just helpful. So I wanted to do that as part of that. So is the first and second still on board with that? No, it's a plan there. Our Chris, call for a vote.
All those in favor of continuing the discourse in the next hour? Amen.
Revelation 15, and we'll just finish with this.